Osiris.
Hey, this is Nat Keefe from Hot Buttered Rum. This podcast is part of the Osiris Podcast Network.
I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now. Bob, what's happening?
I'm actually in Fargo, North Dakota, because we had a gig that we canceled today.
Oh, no.
Because of weather, because there's ice on the stage. And
on the stage?
On the stage. And this morning you had these amazing crew guys literally chopping the ice up and sweeping it. And what we just realized is it was just going to freeze again tonight because they're having, for them, unseasonably cold temperatures. So we have canceled our show. We've rescheduled it for, I believe it's May 16th, 2019.
That sounds like a better time for less ice.
It is. I feel bad for the people that are coming. I mean, we got some tweets and stuff from people coming from Canada and coming from all over. You know, we're playing tomorrow night, which this will all be passed by the time this airs. We're playing in Duluth tomorrow night. I think some people are going to go to that show. I feel bad for the folks who've made special arrangements to come and see us, but it was best for the safety of our crew, for the audience, it being so cold. Although I know people up here, they're hardy folk. They can handle it. They're the toughest of the tough. And let me say, we've been in Minnesota for a few days now, and here now we're going to play in Moorhead, Minnesota, which is adjacent to the Fargo metropolitan area, I would say. But is there a saying, a phrase, Minnesota nice? I think there is.
There is now.
And because everybody up here in this part of the world is so genuinely kind. Wherever you go, people are just very... There's a baseline courtesy that it just seems very genuine and very nice, and it's just very refreshing to be around these people.
Yeah, it's not surprising, Bob. I've been in Minnesota one time, and everyone was nice there. I went to Minnesota in 2010. You want to know why I went to Minnesota, Bob?
You went to the Mayo Clinic because you weren't feeling well.
No, I went to do something else. I went to do something else that made me feel better, though. I came to see you guys play.
At the zoo.
Yeah.
That was a different time. But we, 2004, 5, we literally drove from North Carolina to the Minnesota Zoo, played for 30 minutes. We opened for the late, great Clarence Gatemouth Brown and the late, great Dan Hicks.
Wow.
And immediately turned around and drove back to North Carolina.
Those were the days, man.
those were not the days.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I saw you guys play outside some kind of church and art space there. It was pretty great. You know, there's been these times that I've been watching you guys get bigger and bigger, and I love it because you always stay true. And I remember me and Scott went off, and Scott talked to so many people, and then me and Scott talked for a while. When I came back, everybody was like, he'll talk to everybody. He won't be able to sing tonight because he loves talking to fans so much.
That's
right. That's so beautiful.
It's a problem. I mean, it's a problem. I've actually seen people try to get away from him. He's talking to them. They have to go, and he's, where are you going? Get back here.
We got
I
so
have
much
more to say. You will listen to me.
Yeah. So beautiful, man, because I don't know, like I've watched you guys and like, it's a responsibility. Like whenever you're an artist that people like and you know, you have a responsibility to them. And I don't know, I think the things that are the biggest flaws in us are the things we admire when other people don't have.
Sure.
And like, my thing is like, the corruption by power, like what power does to people and celebrity and everything. So I think that's why I've been so amazed watching you guys over the years. It's really awesome to see that you keep your heads about you and you're still the same people I knew growing up.
Scott and Seth are genuinely humble and see this all as a bigger, as something, part of something bigger. And yeah, it's very nice.
And Bob, if they were somehow to abuse their power, commit other high crimes and misdemeanors, why, how would we get rid of them, Bob?
Well, the definition of high crimes and misdemeanors tends to be subjective and political, but if they did, I would probably file articles of impeachment against them. Yes, I would hate to do it, but if I had to, if it was if the Ava brothers were in jeopardy of soiling our core principles and our constitution, I would have to I would have to bring up articles of impeachment against Scott and Seth.
Yes, and a lot of people are probably going, well, let's say Scott and Seth needed to be impeached, and somehow one of them was the president. Well, today we have an episode. As it turns out, it's crazy that this conversation went in this direction.
Yes.
Because this episode is with the wonderful Jeffrey Engle from Southern Methodist University on his new book that he's co-published, Impeachment in American History. It's going to be out October 16th. We got a copy of it in advance. It's got chapters on the Johnson impeachment by John Meacham, Richard Nixon impeachment by Timothy Naftali, Bill Clinton impeachment by Peter Baker, and the overview, introduction, and a guide to what the founders meant whenever they put impeachment into the Constitution, by the man himself, Jeffrey Engle, who is here on this episode to explain all of this to us. And he's awesome.
So great. And all four of those authors, if you're a political junkie and you watch cable news, you've seen them all. These guys are always making the rounds and always, I would call them expert witnesses and commentators on all things historical and particularly political. So we're so lucky to be able to speak with guys like Jeffrey. And the best part of it was that we had it was a lovely afternoon.
It really was.
It was just one of the best conversations, and we all had a great time doing it. It definitely transcended the idea of, well, we're doing this podcast interview about this book. It became a bunch of guys who are really interested in this topic, shooting the hay, if that's a saying. It is now. We're just going to create all kinds of
Minnesota nice shooting the hay. Yes. Just shooting the hay with that Minnesota niceness.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, he was, Jeffrey Engle was just very, very generous with his time and, just a really great guy. We laughed a lot and we talked about some serious issues at the same time. So
we hope you enjoy this episode. And this book, I got to say, it's coming out tomorrow after this episode airs, October 16th. And I will be assigning portions of this book in my class. It is concise and direct. And I think everything you want to check out if you're interested in the topic of impeachment. The name of the book is Impeachment and American History. It is co-authored by John Meacham, Timothy Naftali, Peter Baker, and today's guest, Jeffrey A. Engle. It is out from Modern Library on October 16th. We are here with Dolph Ramsor, who you may know is the sponsor of our podcast, the original sponsor of our podcast, the godfather of North Carolina music.
Dolph being a sponsor of our show literally helps us keep the lights on, keeps batteries in the Zoom recorder, keeps the microphone cables working. Dolph, we appreciate all your support over the past year.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be a part of it.
We've been running an ad for the Ruin Brothers, which is one of the new albums that came out that you guys put out, but was produced by Rick Rubin, correct?
Correct. Correct.
I texted Dolph after the second time we ran it and told him that I've never seen a more effective advertisement because it had worked on my entire family. Because after I heard that ad on my own podcast a couple times when I was editing it, my wife listens to the Ruin Brothers all the time now, and I've listened to that album several times. It worked on us, man.
Well, that's great to know. That's great. And they're such talented guys, and they're sweet fellas as well. They're from the north of England, Scunthorpe, which is a very working class area, but they're really good guys.
Dolph, you have a few newer groups on your roster. Is there anybody that you'd like to tell us about?
Well, we just signed a band called Sammy Miller and the Congregation, and that's a unique one because it's a jazz band, and this is the first jazz band I have worked with. But they're a very unique band because it's kind of joyful jazz. They do a lot of comedy bits within the jazz that they play. It's really unique. It's almost very much like early Avett Brothers when you had to go see the band to sort of get it.
So yeah, so we're grateful we had you as sponsors. And as I said the first time we had you on the introduction, maybe over a year ago, and I said that I've known Dolph like over a decade, and he's only ever sponsored really good things and put his name behind really good things. And I didn't know if this was going to be the one that broke him, and I didn't want to be a part of it. But a year later, we're still going, and we're thankful for it.
Well, again, glad to be a part of it, and y'all keep rocking. I'll keep rocking and having some fun doing it.
Big team, little me.
Yes.
That's right. So check out the Ruin Brothers album and all the other albums and the bands on Ramsar Records. You can go to ramsarrecords.com, and you can, if you're interested in any of the albums there, you can enter the promo code HISTORY and get 10% off. So go do it. Show Dolph some love, and we're thankful for him.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Engel, welcome to The Road to Now.
Hi.
We're going to talk about your newest book in just a minute, but we have you here on a day where there's breaking news. Nikki Haley, the ambassador to the United Nations, has announced her resignation this morning, along with President Trump. It seems to be the most amicable departure from the Trump administration yet. And I know you've been teaching all day, so it's possible you haven't seen any of the video footage of it. But I just you know, as someone who's an expert on American diplomatic history, just a few comments on how Nikki Haley's role was as ambassador, and maybe the larger context of her resignation in light of the National Security Council and John Bolton's rising prominence in the Trump administration?
Sure. Those are both great questions. You know, I think Nikki Haley to date has given a public face, and as a historian, I have to stress that, you know, what we know of the public face is not what we're going to discover in 25 years when we get the documents. But she has given the public face of being, in many ways, a conscience for this administration, that she has been one of the few people who's been willing to stand up and say, actually, no, we have a moral center as a country, and actually, no, our administration is not following that moral center. Now, she's done it, you know, she's a pretty good diplomat. She's done it as diplomatically as possible. She has never, to my mind, come out and said the president is immoral, but she has certainly come out and said we need to be more moral. And it's going to be curious to me to see if anyone else is willing to step into that role. I mean, we've seen in the broader context of the national security and foreign policy establishment, really a siloing of decision-making, a siloing of responsibilities where, for example, Secretary Mattis is basically only working on Pentagon issues and is not willing to comment on other things. Same thing with Secretary Pompeo, with only working on certain foreign policy issues. And Nikki Haley was one of the few people who was really willing to sort of step out and talk about the broader goals of the administration. And therefore, really the only one who's left talking about the broader goals of the administration on a foreign policy level, aside from spokespeople, is the president himself. And that is remarkably problematic because Donald Trump is frequently at odds with his own presidency and frequently at odds with his own government. I am hard-pressed to think of any previous time on a major issue where the National Security National Security Advisor or the Secretary of State had to come out and say, well, I understand what the president just said, but the policy of the U.S. government is the following. Being different. That's shocking. That's astounding. And John Bolton has had to do that several times already on important issues, as important as our relations with Russia, as important as our relations in the Middle East, as important as our relations towards North Korea. It's just genuinely shocking for the President of the United States to be at odds with his own administration. So what that tells me is that with Nikki Haley gone and with that siloing going on and continuing within Washington, we're going to hear not so much more of Trump, because we already hear a lot of him, but rather we're not going to hear any pushback on Trump from within the administration.
So how's John Bolton doing in that position? I mean, you wrote a book about reforming the National Security Council. Do you have an opinion or any thoughts on his performance thus far?
That's a really difficult question to answer from the outside. The major takeaway from our book was that people need to do a better job of integrating and speaking with each other across military and diplomatic and security disciplines. Now, that sounds obvious, easy to say. Of course, we want to have more communication. But what it really means is that people need to recognize that their proper decision in their sphere may actually have knock-on consequences for other people. You know, so I'll give you an easiest example of all. You know, the Pentagon may decide to blow up an enemy camp because that's where the enemy is. And they have to ask themselves, what are the diplomatic consequences going to be? What are the media consequences going to be? What are the political consequences going to be? And they can't really ask those questions of themselves. They have to be in communication with the people who know the answers to those questions, whether it's the State Department or other elements of the government. So what I've seen thus far within the Trump administration is, in addition, and under Bolton as National Security Advisor, in addition to a real disconnect between what the president says and what the actual policies are, I've seen that Bolton as National Security Advisor seems not to understand the principal role of the National Security Advisor, which is not to be a policy maker, which is not necessarily to be a policy advisor. It's really to be a coordinator of all the different facets of the national security state. You know, the national security advisor is traditionally the person who brings everyone to the table and has to be an honest broker presenting different opinions to the president, including his own, but he can't privilege his or her own. And thus far, I think Bolton is thinking of himself as a strategist. And I don't know that's necessarily the right role for a national security advisor. Traditionally in history, when we see national security advisors get engaged in strategy, to be honest, it rarely winds up well. The best example, of course, is Iran-Contra, where once you start operationalizing things out of the White House, the national security advisor is not doing his or her job as a gatekeeper. They're actually making policy, which means there's nobody minding the gate.
So was this something in terms of expanding the power and maybe going too far with it? Is this something you saw also in Kissinger? Because Kissinger was known for being pretty much a someone who had a grand strategy he was working on, right?
Yeah, you know, Kissinger's kind of in a category unto himself, to be honest. you know, because he thought in macro historical terms. But I will tell you, he was terrible, absolutely terrible, at running that gatekeeper job. Because he did not want other people to have access to the president. He did not want other people to give their opinions to the president. He wanted the president to listen to him and only him. You know, and listen, every administration has its own character, and different systems work for different administrations. My baseline is that what I want to see within a national security operating system for an administration is a plan, is a method, is a way of doing things, in a way of disseminating and collecting information and making policy decisions. We just don't see that within the Trump administration, and we don't see it because that there is a person at the very top who is at odds with his own policymakers. I mean, what the president says and what the policies of the U.S. government are not always consistent, and that is, I wouldn't say unprecedented, but it is shocking.
And let's move to the book that comes out on Tuesday, October 16th. Impeachment and American History. What's interesting about this book right off the top is that it has four contributing authors: John Meacham, Tim Naftali, Peter Baker, and yourself. Can you tell us, just to start out, the genesis of this project and how the four of you came together?
Yeah, actually, it's a really insightful story, to be honest, because I think it shows the utility of academic centers. We always say that we want to bring people together into academic settings and have them engage with each other, because the sum total of their thinking is greater than their individual parts. And this is a great example. So I direct the Center for Presidential History here at Southern Methodist University, and we have numerous brainstorming sessions about what are the great important issues that are coming up in history or in politics or in different fields that we might want to have people come to campus to discuss, or maybe we want to investigate further ourselves. And of course, the topic of impeachment, you know, has been in the news, shall we say, within the last year and a half, in a way that it hadn't been since Bill Clinton's presidency. And the question was raised, well, what do the previous historical examples of impeachment tell us about the prospects for impeachment going forward? And of course, this, you know, being an academic center, we started saying, well, maybe we could do a conference. Well, maybe we could do a seminar. And then finally, I said, you know, I happen to know people who are experts on each of those three examples. Let me see if they want to just get together and do a book that we can present to the general public. And that's really the largest complexity to the story, which is that there is none. We decided that this was really a critical issue that the American people are going to be discussing, most likely. They're certainly already discussing it more than they have in previous administrations. Just to give you, you know, one statistic, at the beginning of 2018, more Americans reported that they were in favor of impeaching the president than reported that they were planning to vote for his reelection, which is just an astounding, almost unprecedented number. And if the nation is going to have a discussion about something as important as removing a president, we firmly believe that you need to know what you're talking about in terms of history. You know, what happened before? What are the lessons? What can you learn? And what roads do you not want to go down? And the only way to do that is by getting good history. So rather than have a book on impeachment that has 180 pages on why you should or should not impeach Donald Trump and 6 pages of history, we thought, what if we did the exact opposite and gave people 150 pages of history and then tried to explain in briefer terms what it meant for today. But the history is really first and foremost.
What I love about this book is the way it opens up, and it's very honest about the fact that, like, we know why you're reading this book right now. it's not even a question. We know why. And then you say, you make this point, which is beautiful, which is whatever you think about this, you should be informed, as you just said. And you write in very clear and very excellent language. I got to tell you, I sat down to read this last night and I was tired and I was just like, I'll probably just, you know, read a couple pages before I go to sleep. I read like 70 pages of it. Like I read,
oh, great.
And it's so, it just flows beautifully. And your contribution to the book is, whereas the other three contributions are a chapter on each of the three cases of impeachment or near impeachment when it comes to Nixon, yours is on the context in which the idea of impeachment was put into the Constitution. And I'm going to start out here by asking a question that was actually submitted also by one of our patrons on Patreon, Chris Kite Kelly. Why did the framers decide to lay out a process for impeachment? And what did they mean when they said the president shall be removed on conviction of, quote, treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors? That last part being kind of confusing to a lot of people.
Yeah, those are two really great questions. I think the first one actually can be answered relatively easily to remember that these are people who have just thrown off sovereign authority. They have just had a revolution against the legal ruler of their country, of their nation. And the reason that that revolution went forward, at least in ideological terms, it was because that the leader of the country was not doing what's right for the people. It was a very Lockean revolution. If you go back to look at the American Declaration of Independence, it's basically a legal indictment of King George III. He did not handle his affairs right. He harmed us. He hurt our ports. He hurt our trade. He imposed war upon us, making the Lockean argument that a leader that does not do good by his people is a leader that should be removed. Well, take that one step further. Even in a republic, which we're trying to create in the 1770s and 1780s, even in a republic, one has to imagine that there's going to be leaders who could get into office who are, for whatever reason, either maliciously or simply by incompetence, not what the people need at that moment. In fact, not more than not what the people need, that are actually detrimental to the people. So the question of impeachment was, by and large, within the Constitutional Convention, not a question of if, it was a question of how. There was a general recognition, not universal, but general, that there needed to be some mechanism for controlling an out-of-control chief executive. How to do it was really where the major discussion came in. And then to your second question, why to do it? And that was actually the part which I found most fascinating in going back and looking at this anew, that there was a general discussion that incompetence and stupidity what they actually used the term maladministration, which is to say doing your job badly, was not a good reason to impeach somebody. And the reason was because that is a judgment call, and judgment calls are what politics are all about. So if you allowed the Congress, for example, as it became evident, would be the mechanism. If you allowed the Congress to remove a president because they didn't think he was doing a good job, well, that basically is making him ultimately subservient to the Congress. Therefore, the charges had to be more specific. They had to come up with things which were irrefutably crimes against the state that would harm the nature of the republic. So bribery, obviously, is one of those, abusing your office. But also a treason, obviously, abusing your office and handing it over to a foreign power. But then also high crimes and misdemeanors. And what's fascinating to me is that we puzzle over this question in the 20th and 21st century. What does high crimes and misdemeanors mean? There was no puzzle in 1787. It was actually such an extraordinarily well-understood and obvious term that there's actually very little discussion of it within the Constitutional Convention, because a high crime is not a regular crime. It's not assault. It's not jaywalking. A high crime is a crime that's against the state or the body politic, or in a republic, the people. So if you are doing something which is a crime against the people and using your office to harm the people or to benefit yourself at the expense of the people, that's a high crime. And that's something which should be cause for removal from office.
So it's possible that being proven to have colluded or been in conspiracy with a foreign power during an election would possibly be a high crime, but yet tax fraud may not be a high crime when it comes to the president.
Yeah, this is something that I think people have to get their minds around. There's kind of a long-standing myth in American discussion of this in legal history and in political discussions that a high crime has to be a crime. And it's just not true. One can commit a high crime without it being illegal. It would be possible to, let's say, just hypothetically, let's say that we had a candidate who colluded with a foreign power in order to win an election. You know, you might be hard-pressed to find specifically which law was broken at what particular time in the execution of that, especially if it's before they took office. But we all know that's something we don't want. That's bad for the state. So that would be an example of a crime, a high crime that is not necessarily a crime. By the same token, one can easily – tax evasion is a good one. I actually prefer jaywalking is my favorite right. example. You know, the president could jaywalk and, you know, we can have a discussion over whether or not he should be indicted or whether or not we should have a grand jury investigation of his jaywalking. But no reasonable person can think that jaywalking makes you unfit to be president. It's laughable on the face of it. So just commission of a crime is not reason enough to trigger impeachment. And by the same token, impeachment doesn't require commission of a crime.
I love that the way you set it up in your chapter, which is if you want to know what the framers thought of as non-presidential, you would have to understand that the quintessentially presidential person in the room when they were writing this was George Washington. And so the person they would want to impeach was basically the opposite of him. And could you talk about the role that he plays in shaping the notion of impeachment? And kind of those, I was really amused by the funny moments where they're kind of embarrassed to even talk about it because he's sitting there.
Oh, it's actually astounding. You know, one of the problems with studying and thinking and writing about George Washington is you come away saying no human being could possibly be this good. he had mistakes. He had flaws. I mean, he had a temper. He was always in debt. He had difficulty making friendships because he was kind of uptight as a way to control his temper. And of course, I think most importantly, you know, he owned other human beings and profited from that. So there is no way to suggest that George Washington is a perfect human being. But he did have essentially perfect virtue, which is to say civic virtue, which is to say it was clear in every single exchange, engagement, discussion, decision that George Washington was involved in, that he was concerned about the welfare of the people, the welfare of the community, and not his own. He could put his own needs aside, if you will. And that's ultimately what people at the convention thought a president should be. And he was really the ideal model for a president, because everyone had trust, not necessarily in what he had done and not necessarily in his judgment, and certainly not necessarily his intelligence. I don't think that people would look at him and say, if you start ranking the, you know, the philosophical IQs of all the people at the Constitutional Convention, you'd find Washington lower down the list, shall we say, than at the top. But no one was trusted more. No one was trusted more to do explicitly what was right for the state. And this does cause, as you mentioned, really awkward moments, because it's so obvious from the moment that Washington accepts his nomination to the Constitutional Convention, which is something he really didn't want to do, because frankly, he had already fought a war. He had already been retired for a few years. He wanted out of politics. He was done. He was tired, and he had every reason to be so. Once he accepts his invitation to the Constitutional Convention, it's very clear two things. First, he's going to be elected the leader of the Constitutional Convention. And secondly, that now the Constitutional Convention has a chance to succeed because he has lent it his authority. He is the only man in the country who is universally admired. And I really think we can use the word universally there, which creates awkward moments when people say, you know, let's discuss in our convention, what do we do with a terrible president? You can kind of hear a pause and all eyes turn to Washington to say, well, we're not talking about you, George. You know, just this is theoretical, you know. And actually several different moments in the Constitutional Convention, Ben Franklin and others have to say to people, listen, everybody, ignore the elephant in the room. Let's talk about this as a serious issue and just not be embarrassed about it. And, you know, in fact, James Madison's notes actually include a couple places where he says, you know, a pause ensued. This was not a group that was known to pause. So the fact that they were feeling awkward tells you just how obvious it was that the man they were discussing, the office they were discussing, was going to be held by the man at the front of the room.
You know, and jumping from George Washington, a man of great civic virtue, to a president who, you've made me think, we need to go back and reassess John Tyler's presidency.
Yeah, agreed.
Because you discuss him for a moment in the introduction as one who survived an impeachment vote, but also, you know, he was the first vice president to assume the role with the passing upon the passing of William Henry Harrison, and there was no precedent, and there's so many precedents he set presidentially. Well, so did John Tyler in many ways. Can you talk about him surviving that vote and why that vote came up in the first place?
Sure. I mean, I agree with you. Tyler's actually fascinating, and it's difficult to paint Tyler entirely as a hero in this story, because, you know, he was difficult, and in particular, he ultimately decides to turn traitor and seek election to the House of Representatives for the Confederacy. He dies before he's able to assume that office. But so he's not necessarily a heroic figure in every way. But here's a moment where he really stood up for what he interpreted the Constitution to mean. You know, Harrison had formed his cabinet. Harrison had campaigned on a certain number of policies. He had a platform. And Tyler, as the vice president, was brought in for, as all vice presidents are, for political rounding, if you will. He was not a Harrison man. Therefore, when Harrison dies, the cabinet quite rightly said, well, we know what the president wanted to do, and he was the man that was elected. So therefore, this platform was elected. Let's go forward, and, you know, let's govern by consensus. You know, you signed the documents, Mr. President, but, you know, we all know that this is a group decision. And Tyler said, no, that is, I am responsible. I am the executive. Nowhere in the Constitution does it say the vice president must assume the policies of the president. It says the vice president assumes the responsibilities of the president, and that means doing things the way you think are best, and immediately creates a fissure with the cabinet, which leads increasingly to calls for his removal. And in a sense, this is one of the times where impeachment really does have a logic to it, because, you know, if you firmly believe that the president and an administration are elected by the sovereign will of the people, the next person in line without an election could still be beholden to that sovereign will of the people. So you have an interesting philosophical argument over whether or not Tyler had the right approach, I think he did personally, of assuming responsibility and making the administration his own. But everything he did was completely unprecedented in that context. And as with most unprecedented things, it either works brilliantly or not at all. And in his case, largely not at all, which in the sense that he became disliked by every different aspect of the government and wound up, you know, serving out his term.
So from George Washington, his excellency, to John Tyler, his accidency.
Yes, yes. You know, and you know, going back, you know, I like to think that a really good shorthand for impeachment, you know, those bracelets that say, you know, what would Jesus do or what would Mahatma Gandhi do, you know, is what would George Washington not do? would tell you something that's useful for impeachment. And John Tyler is an interesting example of that because people from the beginning were able to say, well, what George Washington wouldn't do is put himself above the people who elected him, in a sense. And that was an argument against Tyler, that he had decided that his executive authority and the responsibility of his authority mattered more than what the people had voted upon. Ultimately, as a 20th and 21st century person, we have come to understand that's just a logical necessity of transfer of power, but it was certainly novel when he was going through it for the first time.
Oh my God, I hate to, it's in my mind right now and I can't stop thinking it. It's like, gee, I wonder if there's like somebody we could think right now who's like the opposite of Washington, and what would happen if every American read a book about George Washington? Maybe that would either change their opinion on politics now, or maybe that would make us turn on George Washington. Who knows? Anything's fair game now.
Well, I hope it doesn't make us turn on George Washington.
No, me either.
You know, I will jump with both feet into that implied question, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
I'm presuming, just my presumption, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm presuming that you're referring to the current president in comparison to
yes, and I hate it. I hate it, but I am. Absolutely. It's just he's the antithesis of Washington, and I think that's an objective analysis.
Well, and you know, this answer is by definition subjective, but I think that one of the really fundamental problems with the Trump presidency is that we are trained as historians not to use the word unprecedented, because that just means you're not thinking hard enough.
Right.
And yet we've run out of synonyms for unprecedented for Trump. In this critical, important context, you know, in previous administrations, and we saw this change a little bit with George W. Bush. We saw this change a little bit with Barack Obama. But at least, you know, before them, with before Clinton even, with H.W. Bush and previous throughout the entire Cold War, I think you could safely make the argument that even people who opposed the president still believed the president had the best interests of the country at heart. That began to wither away, I think, a little bit under Clinton, where people hated him so much they couldn't fathom that he was actually interested in it for the country. And it continued with Obama and continued with George W. Bush in opposite order, of course. I think it's very difficult, personally, to suggest that Donald Trump is interested in being president of all Americans. I think he's interested in being president of the Americans that he represents. And that is something that almost every president, it's a political job. We know you're only trying to get the votes of 50.1% of the population. But upon assuming office, almost every modern day president has said, well, now I have the responsibility for everyone. We don't see that in Donald Trump. We don't see that rhetorically. We don't see that in his actions. We don't see it in his utter lack of empathy and compassion for other people. Which is, you know, a president traditionally is the person who flies into, in recent years, a disaster zone to hug people. Well, the hugs don't help, except it demonstrates that the nation cares about you. Donald Trump flies into places to mock people. And I think that's simply divisive. And that is, if it feels like that's a partisan statement, I'm good with that, because Trump is doing something which is really non-presidential.
Yes, thank you for saying that.
So there have been three presidential impeachments in our nation's history, and I'd like to talk about two of them briefly. I hate to go out of chronological order.
That's cool.
But you mentioned Nixon and then Clinton, and you talk about a backlash is the way I read it, because Nixon he resigns before he's impeached, but then there's Jimmy Carter, you know, Gerald Ford takes the presidency and does not win election. And Jimmy Carter serves one term and does not win re-election. And then we essentially have a Republican president from 1968 accepting Carter till 1992, right? And then Bill Clinton is impeached. He survives being voted out of office, but then Al Gore loses in a close election, and so it seems to be there is this this backlash because Clinton fought being removed from office and he won, but it definitely hurt his party and perhaps his survival had made it more palatable for people to vote for Donald Trump.
I think that's exactly right. You know, it's an interesting question, and actually, the Trump example is particularly interesting. What responsibility does a president who is impeached or a president who is under political assault for one reason or another? What responsibility do they have to the nation to remove themselves if they are a detriment to the nation? No president, to be honest, is ever going to say yes to that question. But I think it's one that they should be answering. And I think ultimately you could say that's why Richard Nixon left, because it was clear to him that, you know, nothing good was going to come from his staying in office. So if there is a discussion that is active today, again, I'll go to the present, because I think that's important for historians to do. If there's a discussion that's active today over whether or not the impeachment of Donald Trump bringing Mike Pence into power would be a good or a bad thing, which is to say, this is a common coffee shop and bar discussion. Would you rather have a President Pence or a President Trump? Because they are completely different personalities, if nothing else. Think of the difference in personality between Al Gore and Bill Clinton on a policy level. I mean, you know, I think we can say that they were different people on how they interacted as a human being with other people. You know, the list of Al Gore's affairs is remarkably small compared to Bill Clinton's. But find me the policy difference. Whereas I think you could say that if Mike Pence came in, there would be a different policy agenda for the United States. Maybe there would be more emphasis on the social and cultural programs as opposed to trade, shall we say. So ultimately, there is a tremendous backlash for the president, and that one might argue that Bill Clinton I would argue, in fact, that Bill Clinton, by pursuing with such vigor his desire to stay in office, which is not unreasonable for a president to want to desire, made it possible for Al Gore to lose. Al Gore had to run away from Clinton in 2000, and George W. Bush's greatest argument against the potential Gore administration was we need to throw out people who had any connection with the sullying of the White House. And that was actually appealing to American voters, despite the fact that Bill Clinton was remarkably popular and successful. So if you play out the theoretical question of whether or not, if Bill Clinton had actually resigned in 1998, when it seemed highly likely he might, and Al Gore came in, well then, if Al Gore continues the popular policies of Bill Clinton, it's likely Al Gore wins himself in 2000. So Clinton's not only sexual deviance, I would say, and then his subsequent impeachment, but then his ultimate decision to hang on no matter what really does pave the way for the other party to take the White House.
And so now we're in this Me Too moment, if you will. And when Al Franken was accused, you had a Democratic Congressman Kirsten Gillibrand come out and kind of push him out the door, mm-hmm. and then kind of turned on Bill Clinton, turned on the Clintons, who she was close with, and said, you know, it's time to reassess the way Bill Clinton is remembered. So do we expect to see more of this in the 2020 cycle, almost a reassessment of the Clinton presidency and his legacy?
You know, that's a great question, because I think if there's one thing we've learned about the current political environment, it's that all of our previous rules don't apply. I mean, the number of times that Donald Trump should have been dead in the water as a political candidate are hard to count. And yet, obviously, he survived them all. So therefore, to understand what Bill Clinton's legacy is going to be going forward, you have to grant that, you know, people are, even if they're thinking in new ways, like as in the Me Too moment, that they're still thinking in traditional terms. And it's clear, I think, at this point that Bill Clinton is no longer the hero he once was. There's a real sense, I think, in the late 1990s and 2000s that not just people on the left, but we know from polling data that people across the political spectrum thought, okay, what he did was wrong, but it didn't matter because, you know, it wasn't a high crime. It wasn't something that harmed the state. Well, to be honest, and also because it was a consensual affair was the way people understood it in that period. At this period in time, in 2018, it's really hard to make the argument that that is a consensual affair. The power dynamic between the president and the intern is just so great. And frankly, between a 50-year-old and a 22-year-old is so great. So I think that our discomfort with what Clinton did is only going to rise over time. And frankly, I think his personal popularity is going to plummet. And people are going to remember that he was a popular president, but not a popular person.
Do you think, I don't know, I'm listening to this, and if what you're saying is right, then perhaps, would it be fair to say that the best thing that both Bill and Hillary, whether owed it or not, could do for their party would be just to disappear, just to step away, you think?
I mean, you could have asked that question in 2015. I mean that not hyperbolically, you know. So the really interesting thing to me, I think we're going to look at going back and reviewing the 2016 election, which we're going to be reviewing, you know, all of us for the next 200 years, hopefully, is that we know in politics that once a negative opinion is formed about a person or a candidate, it's almost impossible to remove it. So you can work really hard to get people to like you. And that's a place where you can move from indifference into liking. Once you have dislike, you never get back to indifference, and you certainly never get back to liking. All of which is background to say, you know, Hillary Clinton had, I think the last number I saw was about 52% unfavorable rankings from the American people while she was running for the Democratic primary. It's hard to imagine any other scenario where a politician would have even thought of continuing on at that point, or where a party would have allowed that person to continue on at that point. So, and I say that as a person who has the greatest amount of respect for Secretary Clinton. I thought that she was by far the most qualified and competent and intelligent candidate, both in the primaries and in the general election. But a person who has been actively disliked for a generation to the point where more than half of Americans actively dislike her is not a person that a party in full judgment should put up for the presidency.
I always told people that the Republicans were digging a Hillary Clinton shaped hole in the ground for like a decade and a half. And everybody was like, but what if Hillary Clinton isn't the one they send down here? And they were like, don't worry, she will be.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's mind blowing.
It is. It really is.
Your co-author, Peter Baker's colleague, Michael Schmidt, broke the Clinton email story in early March of 2015. So right there, that was probably the moment that she should not have announced her candidacy. But hey, hindsight is 2020. I think we need to talk about Andrew Johnson. I don't want to run out of time here without talking about Andrew Johnson for a minute.
Can I just jump in with one more thought about Hillary Clinton?
Please do.
Sure.
It's simply, you know, going back to, I think what you just described is a critical element of why history needs to be studied when we try to understand the present. Any reasonable person in the scenario you just described, of an unpopular politician who then gets a major scandal launched against them in the middle of a campaign, you might say, well, that person should step back. But she's a Clinton, and the Clintons have had a million and one different setbacks and have triumphed over all of them. So it's not surprising to me that Hillary Clinton, having gone through the impeachment of her husband when he should have been dead in the water 17 times at least, and triumphed, it's not surprising that Hillary Clinton would say, well, this is just something else we have to overcome. And I think that finally just caught up with them.
Yeah, the ego it takes to be a politician in the first place.
Yeah. Well, that's I do like to say that, you know, we have to remember that anybody who thinks that out of 300 odd million Americans that they are the only one who should be qualified to be in charge and should have the power to destroy the world at the push of a button, that kind of ego is psychotic. And we should not forget that.
That's so true.
I agree.
So, Andrew Johnson, sorry.
All good. Yeah, so Andrew Johnson, he wasn't Abraham Lincoln. Was that his greatest sin?
You know, I think this is where personality matters. I think he wasn't just Abraham Lincoln. He was a jerk. And it was really hard for Republicans, who of course controlled the Congress at that time, it was really hard for Republicans to get behind a guy who not only was not executing their political agenda, but was simultaneously making profane gestures towards them. I think if he had been a jerk who followed their party line, well, we can think of some examples of where that people will hold their nose and continue to support the president. And if he had been a nice guy and disputed their party line, then that also, I think, would have been survivable, not reelectable, but survivable. It was the combination of his complete asinine arrogance and also his and despicable racial views and also his difficulty with dealing with his majority party, the party that in theory he had run on their ticket for, that ultimately was that combination that was necessary to do him in.
Yeah, just to put this in context, Johnson's fascinating because he was not the original vice presidential candidate for Lincoln. That had been Hannibal Hamblin of New Hampshire, which is one of the most delightful things you can say in the English language. and he replaced him on the ticket in 1864 to try to get the border states to go along with Lincoln because he's worried that he might not win that election. So Johnson comes in. He's one of the East Tennesseans who had been a part of, you know, the only senator to stick around after the Confederates leave. And he's got a very different worldview than your average Southerner because he's from Appalachian Mountains. Slavery isn't really a thing in his part of the world. And so while he is deeply racist, he also doesn't really like the plantation owners so much. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think he's a really fascinating figure in that regard because that he is not only uninterested in moving along with the clear legal changes. I mean, we're not even asking him to move along with the moral and social changes on race that occur because of the Civil War, which, of course, are very slow in coming. Perhaps one could argue haven't even been continued to accomplish to today. But Johnson is also against the legal changes that were wrought by the Civil War because he simply cannot fathom that this should not be a country that is for, by, and run by white people. And so even though he's against slavery or against disrupting the Union, that's a separate question for him than whether or not, you know, every citizen should have equal rights, because he can't fathom that African Americans could be proper citizens because that the country's not for them. It is really remarkable how intolerant he is on this point. And I say this in full recognition that our racial sensibilities in the 21st century are completely different in many ways, hopefully, than they were in the 1850s, 60s, and 70s. And Johnson, I think, was out of step with his own party even at that time.
So in a world where even being out of step with perhaps what the radical Republicans wanted, there was still a lot of people who had very strong mm-hmm. notions of racial order in the United States, certainly at this time. This is before Dred Scott's overturned by the 14th Amendment. What is it then that leads Congress to decide to make the man the first one they ever really get to impeach? What is it that pushes him over for him?
You know, ultimately it's that he consistently defies congressional authority. And by congressional authority at this time, I mean the strong majority hold that the Republicans have on the post-Civil War Congress. Specifically, you know, there is a lot of difficulty in how the War Department and the executive branch is going to execute congressional will on Reconstruction. And Johnson consistently puts people in power who are more likely to put their own views on Reconstruction into practice than necessarily what Congress wants. And Congress therefore passes an act that says, well, if you are going to, that we have the right to review any change that you make within your cabinet. And that becomes a violent issue because the Constitution gives Congress the right to advise and consent, or in our words, approve of a cabinet official, but says nothing about how to remove a cabinet official, or that the president can't choose who he wants to have as a cabinet official, or that the president can't fire a cabinet official. In fact, you could even make the argument at the time, well, if we, the Congress, we, the Senate in particular, have approved of somebody, you do not have the authority to get rid of that person because only we have the authority to get rid of that person. And there's really a sense in which the congressional legislation that comes out banning or barring or making it illegal for Johnson to fire his own people are really done in order to, you know, in a sense, put a cock gun next to his head, that we dislike you so much that we are going to do something, we the Congress, we are going to do something that we're just going to dare you to pull the trigger. And right. Johnson pulls away and winds up firing the Secretary of War, who had been approved by the Senate. And that really is the instigating factor for the actual impeachment proceeding.
You love coffee.
I love coffee.
But I don't really drink coffee.
Our relationship would be so much better if you drank coffee.
I know. And that's why I don't drink coffee. But anyway.
But I ordered some coffee because we have a sponsor called La Cosecha Coffee.
Salt of the earth. Jamie Jeske. Great guy. Beautiful family.
They do everything right, you know? And my wife drinks coffee. And I like coffee, like, sometimes, right? So I ordered this coffee, ground it up, and Bob, I like that coffee.
You mean you like coffee now?
Yes.
You like La Cosecha Coffee.
I like La Cosecha. And this sounds like a 1950s advertisement, but it's actually the truth. Because I didn't have to be like, we had an ad for this for La Cosecha, and it was working fine. They're getting orders from us because you guys are awesome. And apparently, repeat orders because people order it and realize how good it is.
We have a very loyal and dedicated group of listeners out there.
Yes, and
such good people.
Yeah, if you haven't tried this coffee from La Cosecha, give it a shot. Because honestly, I still don't drink coffee that very often, but I look forward to drinking a cup of that coffee sometimes. You can go to lacosechacoffee.com. And you can go there and order some of their coffee. They have a lot of different varieties. They roast it themselves. They have direct relationships with the farms that produce them so that they get paid well. And if you go to lacosechacoffee.com and you enter the promo code RTN10, that's RTN, the number 10, you get 10% off your order of La Cosecha Coffee. And they've been great sponsors for us and good people. And you notice we've been doing this podcast for 2 years. We've only ever had two sponsors. We kind of work on the Paul Harvey model that, like, we're not, you know, we've had other people talk to us about it. We really want to believe in the stuff that we advertise, and we're happy to say that these guys are great, and we hope you'll check them out.
Please do. And Ben, your relationship with your wife will be so much better now that you drink coffee, because you guys can have a cup of coffee together in the morning.
So Bob, you're saying that every day that I don't drink a cup of coffee is me being deliberately antagonistic towards my wife and our relationship?
No, you're projecting.
La Cosecha Coffee.
Brett Kavanaugh was sworn in officially, I guess, or at least ceremonially last night by President Trump in the, I guess, the East Room of the White House. And there's already talk by some on the left of investigating him if the House turns Democratic and they get the subpoena power and maybe impeaching him ultimately. Although I think that's a stretch. There was a Supreme Court justice who was impeached, or at least attempted to be impeached, correct?
Yes. Old Bacon Face.
Yes.
Who is that, Ben?
Old Bacon Face.
Old Samuel Chase. have you studied him in your studying of impeachment for this book?
I'll be honest. I didn't know he was called Old Bacon Face, so I suspect you know more about this than I do.
Either did I.
I teach all like undergraduate freshmen in my U.S. history class. You think I'm not going to drop somebody whose nickname is Old Bacon Face that in the middle of a lecture?
Was it meant as a compliment or as an insult?
I don't know the origins exactly. I just know it was.
I mean, I love bacon.
So, I know, but I mean, you know, Bacon Face.
But let me say, Bacon Face. That would be a Trump. That would be a Trump diss, right?
That would actually
a Trump nickname.
You know, I think what would be interesting about the potential for a Kavanaugh inquiry and impeachment is I don't think there's any way that one could impeach him at this point for things that he has been accused of, by which I mean things that happened earlier in his career, with one exception, which is that if he was found and conclusively found to have perjured himself before Congress, if he lied about something active, and we have proved that we could actually know that he lied, just not to say he was mistaken or misremembered, but that he actively lied. That seems to me the only narrow grounds that Congress would have to impeach him for things that have happened in the past at this point. And I think there's some frustration. Obviously, there's a lot of frustration over his nomination, which is causing people to suggest radical solutions. But I fail to see how that one at this point would produce much good.
But there is a process for impeaching a Supreme Court justice. Is it the same? I mean, how does it differ from the way that the president would be impeached?
You know, actually, it really doesn't, which is to say that it's the same. The impeachment clause actually occurs for all federal appointed officials. So if a person, you know, commits treason, bribery, or a high crime and misdemeanor, then the House will have to do an investigation, and the House will have to pass articles of impeachment, basically a resolution saying we impeach ye. And that has a simple majority. And then it goes to the Senate, where, of course, the Senate has to have a trial, curiously enough, in this case, overseen by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. In fact, a question just occurred to me now. What happens if the Chief Justice is the one who's impeached?
Oh,
that would be interesting. You know, as an irony of fate, it turns out that Bill Clinton's trial was, of course, overseen by Justice Rehnquist, who had previously written a book on Andrew Johnson's impeachment. So in a sense, he knew as much about impeachments as anybody in the room, just wow. a personal interest. In any event, that requires for a conviction, requires a two-thirds majority of the Senate. And that's really where the modern political hang-up is. It's really hard to get two-thirds of the Congress to agree what color the sky is right now. To get them to agree on impeaching a president is, I think, a bridge too far, or a judge is a bridge too far. And what the other interesting thing that the Constitution makes clear that people don't necessarily understand or appreciate is that conviction does not have to lead to removal from office. Conviction can simply mean that a person can have a penalty imposed by the Senate. You know, you could be convicted of a high crime and misdemeanor, impeached, convicted, and retain your office if the Senate decides that the punishment should be censure, or the punishment should be some other political loss.
I was going to add real quick, you could also be impeached, thrown out of office, but not disqualified from running for office again, and just come back next time if people like you.
You know, actually, that's a good question, because the Constitution does say that you can no longer, after you're convicted, that you are no longer able to hold any future high office or appointment from the federal government. But maybe, I'm not a lawyer, so maybe a victory in an election is not an appointment. I have to call somebody in law school.
Yes, yeah. this is a great legal question to ask, and I think you should call. I think you should call Rudolph Giuliani, who's a lawyer, or at least he plays one on television, and you could ask him to chime in on that. Throughout our history, the actual impeachments are rare, but the specter of impeachment is not so rare, right? Mm-hmm. You talk about this in the introduction for the book. Of course, Reagan was threatened with impeachment.
with Iran-Contra, W at the outbreak of the Iraqi war, Obama with the idea of unilaterally going into Syria. So, you know, here we have a lot of talk and some of it grounded in the possible impeachment of Donald Trump. But, you know, I mean, how possible is this in reality?
You know, it is, I think, shockingly possible, which is to say we're having this discussion. You know, all those cases, I think Reagan's is the one where I think you could make the most logical case that that should be that something that his potential impeachment is something that people actively considered. If more information about Iran-Contra had come out demonstrating his direct involvement, I think his impeachment is a real viable question. And it didn't. It really never got to the point of having it be a political discussion, or anything more than a political discussion. For Barack Obama, their discussion of impeachment was internal, which is to say, Obama, when considering whether or not to use unilateral action in Syria, you know, had in the back of his mind that, you know, if I violate congressional opinion, that could be impeachable. And that's about as far as it got. H.W. Bush, I think, is the most interesting one, Bush 41, because he was very explicit at the beginning of the Gulf War, explicit with his own advisors and explicit in his own diary, that, just to remember the history here, the Senate had a debate over whether or not they were going to authorize the president to use force in the Gulf War. As we were thinking of transitioning from Desert Shield into Desert Storm, that was a very contentious debate. And in fact, Bush only received Senate authority, congressional authority, by just a handful of votes. And he was very clear in his diary that even if he lost, even if he didn't have congressional authority, he was going to go to war anyway, for two reasons. First, because he realized he thought it was the right thing to do and that he had a higher responsibility to do the right thing. And that Congress was playing politics, but he had to concern himself with the fate of the world, which is a very hubristic thing to say, I'll admit. And the second thing, and I think this is actually a much more interesting one, is that they were really confident that this war was going to go well at that, you know, in the days leading up to it. I mean, we didn't know how many casualties we would suffer. We didn't know how much destruction would be required, but we knew we were going to win quick, to be honest. And Bush's basic argument is, okay, it's going to take him at least a couple weeks in order to get together articles of impeachment and push them through Congress. In a couple weeks, I'm going to be the most popular president we've ever had because I'm going to be a victorious military leader, and nobody impeaches a victorious military leader. So the politics and the timing actually worked out in his favor as well. Now, it never became relevant because he got the congressional authorization, but he definitely did think about the probability of being impeached in his day. So all of which is to say, presidents in recent history have, you know, engaged on the margin as a parlor question or even as a outside political discussion whether or not impeachment is relevant. This is really, again, another time where we can say Donald Trump is bordering on unprecedented. The idea that he was being actively discussed as a potential impeachable president before he took office is remarkable. It demonstrates the animosity that he generated from among his political opponents and their frustration over watching him win an election that they didn't think he could. And it demonstrates the fact that he clearly is a character. He is an unusual, unpresidential person. And what I love about noting his lack of presidential authority, if you will, in the sense that he often says, you know, I could be more presidential, but I choose not to, is that if you hate him, that's one of the things you hate about him. If you love him, that's one of the things you love about him. So telling people that Donald Trump is unprecedented and non-presidential is basically a Rorschach test for whether or not they think he's a person they like.
Can I just add in here, because I cannot say this. Come on, Bush. You were so sure it was only going to be a very quick war and we were going to win decisively. You know who else thinks that? Like everybody else who starts a war. Like, why don't you ask the Germans about their decision to reopen unrestricted submarine warfare? And, you know, like they were like, ought to be done by the time the Americans get involved. I just had to say that. Everybody thinks the war is going to be short. Don't believe.
Well, let's play with – seriously, that's a great point. And let's play with that idea for a second. I think every president thinks they're going to win the war, or in theory, why are they starting? And most of them, I mean, George W. Bush is a great example. You know, he had the rosy scenario of how things were going to turn out and didn't necessarily think enough about what he wasn't thinking about and what he wasn't planning for. But I consider Bush going to war against Iraq basically the same as Michael Jordan in his prime playing basketball against me. it's possible that I could win. You know, I mean, you know, I was about to say stranger things have happened, but I'm not sure they ever have. But I think Michael Jordan would feel pretty darn confident going into that one.
I would say,
yeah,
so.
Yeah, well, if he loses, it doesn't spiral an entire nation into decades of war. But anyway, I'll back off. what you were saying before gets at a question another question from our patrons, from Jeff LeCain, who he's noted, it seems like over the last few decades, impeachment has been a topic that has been brought up by the opposition party almost from the beginning of each administration. So his question is this unique to our current political climate, or has this been true throughout our political history? And what you just said, which is almost nobody's talked about impeaching a president before they become the president. But do you see this as kind of like, you just mentioned that the last several presidents, it's been kind of on the table. Is this a process that we've seen kind of unfolding, or earlier in the American Republic, were there more, instances of this happening?
No, this is a relatively new thing. I think the degree in which this is an active discussion among Donald Trump is actually also new. There is always somebody in Congress. I mean, Congress is a big body, and it attracts curious personalities. Let's just put it that way. There's always somebody who's willing to walk around the halls of Congress saying, "We should impeach. We should impeach. We should impeach." The president used the wrong dinner fork. We should impeach. It never gets anywhere. Franklin Roosevelt had accusations against him. Herbert Hoover. People discussed maybe we should remove him at the height of the Depression. And reasonable minds recognize after the Andrew Johnson experience that just being bad at your job or just being unpleasant is not sufficient reason. And so the calls for impeaching George W. Bush, the calls for impeaching Barack Obama were basically from people who were not capable of fathoming that that person was president. We're seeing active discussion today. It is an active question, not only impeachment, but whether or not the 25th Amendment should be employed against Donald Trump. And that there's no other way to say that is remarkable. And I think it's testament to two things. I think it's testament to the divisiveness of our political era. And I think it's testament to the fact that Trump, again, like him or hate him, has no interest in playing the traditional role of president. He's playing it his way. You know, it's his right. He's the president. I'm not. But that does generate an increased interest, I think, for people to say that does not look like a president. Therefore, I can start to imagine him not being president.
And I would argue that if Hillary Clinton was president and you had a Republican Congress, we would be hearing about possibly impeaching her as well, going back to the email scandal and Benghazi. Do you agree?
I do. I do absolutely agree. I think I'm 100% in agreement that a Republican-controlled Congress would have begun impeachment investigations or impeachment hearings. Whether or not that would have generated enough energy to get every single Republican on board, or at least a majority of Republicans in the House on board with actually going ahead and having a constitutional crisis, I don't know what would have happened, but I think the idea that there would not have been investigations for Clinton is ludicrous. I think that's the age that we're living in.
So you have.
So I'm agreeing with you, Tyler. Oh, yeah.
Sorry. So you have three co-authors to this book, Impeachment and American History, that comes out on October 16th. It will be available in bookstores where fine books are sold. So it's really interesting to me that you have three history scholars, and then you have Peter Baker, who has, I mean, the guy has a must-read byline in the New York Times. He's one of, like, this. We're in this moment of, like, you want to say second golden age of American journalism, but he's one of the must-read reporters of our time. How did he get involved, and what does he bring to the project?
Well, Peter actually has a really interesting, fascinating background. I mean, to be honest, I think somebody should write a biography of Peter Baker, who writes biographies, because he was, among other things, I have to make sure I get this right, the first print journalist on the ground in Afghanistan after 9/11. And he was also the first person to break the story in print on the team of people that broke the story in print on the Monica Lewinsky scandal. And ultimately, after that, he wrote what is still regarded to be one of the best books on the impeachment of Bill Clinton. So when asking ourselves, you know, who could write on Richard Nixon, Tim Naftali, who's not only a brilliant historian, but also spent years as the director of the Nixon Library and completely redid the Watergate exhibit in particular.
I've been there. It is phenomenal. It is fabulous.
It really is. And you can and the fact that it's good history, you can imagine how difficult that was to get, you know, people in that environment to want to take a critical historical look at this. So he was a great choice. And of course, John has just finished his really wonderful book on the soul of America, and he was thinking about Andrew Johnson and had been working on Andrew Johnson and had some thoughts on Andrew Johnson, but then Peter, I think we really could not find somebody not only who's a brilliant writer and a brilliant journalist and a brilliant political analyst, but he's an expert on Clinton. I mean, it really worked out quite perfectly, and we just could not be more thrilled that. Going back to how the project began, when I sat around with our postdocs and our fellows and said, who would you get? You know, we always, whenever we do these kinds of projects, we make lists of who will ask first, who will ask second, who will ask third. In each president that we decided to study, we didn't have to get past number one on our list. So it really turned out wonderfully.
That's awesome. Well, what about you, Jeff? Because you have this amazing position. You came highly recommended to me. We wanted to do an episode on impeachment for a while. And my old friend and former grad student friend, Brandon Miller, who teaches at your university, texted me and said, you've got to have this guy on the podcast. And less than 24 hours later, we had you locked in. He's great. We're from about the same place in North Carolina. So I've known him. We actually did our master's.
You know, now that you mention it, you sound like him.
I think he sounds more refined than me, but I'll take it. you've written some amazing books, and you're writing in this. Oh my, like I'm gonna assign portions of this to my students next time I teach early American history in particular, because this your piece on the Constitution is really something I've been looking for a while.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's great. How did you decide to become a historian? Like, what was the path? Where did you grow up, and what was the moment jeepers. You knew?
This is no exaggeration. I knew I wanted to be a historian from the age of five. I couldn't fathom doing anything else. The only books I read as a kid were history books. I remember having a long discussion when I was five or so with my father, where he was asking me, we were driving down the New Jersey Turnpike, as a matter of fact, and he was asking me questions to kill the time. This is before satellite radio, about, you know, what war, do you know what war this happened in? Do you know what election this happened in? Do you know what event this was? And I remember at the age of five or six being genuinely feeling a sense of shame that a proper citizen should know the nation's past. It's all I've ever wanted to do. I went history all the way through, and I had a particularly important advantage in writing this piece, because I'm a 20th century historian. I sometimes think of myself as a 21st century historian. I'm trained as a diplomatic historian. I've moved into working on the presidency. My wife is an absolutely brilliant and encyclopedic mind about the revolution and the constitutional period. So I had been enjoying a private tutorial on the Constitution for the last 20 odd years. And so every single idea in that book is actually hers.
Wow.
It's always great when a husband gives credit where credit is due.
Well, and it's also, you know, as Henry Kissinger used to say, it's a good theory and has the added advantage of being true.
Yes. Way to bring it back around. Well, Ben, do you have any other questions?
No, just thank you so much. This was great. And I can't wait to share this with people. Jeff Ingles, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Man, this was a great conversation. Thank you guys a lot. I love your show.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. The Road to Now is produced by Ben Sawyer and Bob Crawford. Today's episode is edited by Gary Fletcher. We want to thank our Patreon members for their continued support, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Peggy Donica, Jeff LeCane, and Fig White. To join our team of patrons and get extra content, you can go to patreon.com/theroadtonow, or just go to theroadtonow.com, our website, and click on the support tab at the top of our page. If you're unable to support us financially, that's okay. We've all been there before. You can still support us, though, by telling a friend about our podcast and by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. That only takes a few minutes, and it does a lot to help us spread the word. The Road to Now is produced by Bob Crawford and Ben Sawyer. Our social media manager is Austin Sawyer. And today's music, like almost always, is by the talented and lovely Paul DeFiglia. For the Road to Now crew, I'm Ben Sawyer. Take care.